I want to begin this afternoon by asking you a very personal question. But please don't take it personally, because I'm not going to ask you what your answer is or challenge you on what your answer might be. But here's the question. Are you normal? Now, each one of us is unique. We each have our own personality, our temperament. The experiences that we have shape our character and our background, and they tend to define us as a package as far as who we are. But are you normal? Now, in a way, we all want to be different because we don't really want to be exactly like somebody else or a number of other people. People express their individuality in the way they dress, what they do with their hair, the kind of language they use, any number of personal choices that may tend to associate them with a particular group or distinguish them from others. But at the same time, most people don't want to be too different, don't want to be considered weird or abnormal. There are too many social implications to that. So there's a range of behavior into which we can fit. We can be different from others, but still be normal. Well, let's expand that thought a little bit and think about the world we live in. Is this world normal? One definition for the word normal is something that is typical or expected, not out of the ordinary. My wife and I were watching the local television news recently. It was a normal news broadcast. In the first 10 minutes of the newscast, it was reported that in the previous 24 hours in the Pittsburgh area, there had been 4 shootings, 2 of which were fatal, a house fire with another fatality, a car accident in which 2 teens were killed, and an update on a disgraced ex-football coach accused of molesting at least a dozen boys over a period of several years. In other words, your typical daily newscast. And then you throw in a few other regional or national stories about a school shooting in California, soldiers killed in Afghanistan, the threat of Iran's nuclear weapons or potential for nuclear weapons, political candidates squabbling and posturing, the failing national economy, the struggling international economy. It just goes on and on. But frankly, it's nothing out of the ordinary. Not all that surprising. As I said, normal is at least partly defined by what we have come to expect and what is typical. So all in all, it was a normal newscast. You can turn on your television, you see the programming is filled with graphic brutality and violence, blatant immorality, but that's what you expect. That's normal. You can give some thought to other things that you see happening around you every day and consider whether or not they're normal. For the most part, they are. But just because something is normal, it's pretty obvious that it doesn't mean that it's right, or that it's the way that it should be. There are, in fact, other definitions of the word normal, and we'll get to that a little bit later. What does it really mean to be normal? You see, one of the hazards we face, all of us, is that we grow up in and we live in a world that is designed by Satan himself. And one of his great deceptions is to create events, circumstances, trends that happen continually and therefore become normal when in fact they are completely abnormal. The title of the sermon today is Normal Living in an Abnormal World. Since we live in Satan's world, I think it's important that we are careful that we don't accept his standard as being normal. Today I'd like you to consider what normal really is, and certainly from our perspective, what normal ought to be for us as Christians. Now, to illustrate the points that I hope to make today, we'll consider the story of a family that was devastated because they fell into the trap of thinking that the society that they lived in was normal. And it caused, as I said, devastating results in their lives. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 13. Genesis, the 13th chapter. I'm just going to summarize the first half or so of the chapter. It's an easy story flow to read. You can go back and look at it. When Abraham left Haran, which was somewhat north of the area of land of Canaan, and he moved down into Canaan where God told him to relocate, Abram brought with him his nephew named Lot. Lot's father had died, Abram's brother. We're not told how old Lot was when he lost his father. We're not told anything else about the rest of his family, about his mother or whether he had any siblings. But it seems that Abram and Sarah, who at this point were already, Abram was 75 years old when he moved into Canaan, Abram and Sarah had no children of their own, so they took in Lot and they cared for him. And when they moved, they brought him along. Obviously, by this time, Lot was an adult, and Abram and Lot, it turns out, were both very wealthy to the point that living together became a problem for them. There was quite a bit of rivalry between the shepherds and the herdsmen that each of them employed. Some argument probably about grazing land and about water, all kinds of difficulties had begun to arise. So Abram suggested that they go different directions, that they each take their wealth, their families, and their flocks and go in different directions. He gave Lot the first choice as to where he wanted to live. Look at verse 11 here in this chapter. Genesis 13, verse 11, Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. Lot chose to go east, which happened to be the good choice as far as what God had in mind, what God was offering, because he wanted the land of Canaan, which would have been from where they were into the west, to be Abraham's inheritance. So Lot chose to go in the opposite direction. It seems that Lot was drawn into the culture and the environment of the people in that region. It says, notice that Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, but Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain. For whatever reason, Lot and his family seemed to have been attracted to this culture and to the society of the area that they moved toward. Maybe his wife and daughters were tired of living as nomads, tired of living in a tent. They wanted someplace permanent, more comfortable, more exciting, with other people around. I'm kind of speculating, but it appears that they wanted to do more than just spend their lives sitting in a tent counting the sheep. As we continue into chapter 14, we see that Lot's family got caught up in kind of a turf war. There were a lot of villages and small towns in the area, each of which had its own king. And there was one king in particular who decided to ally himself with others and began to attack the other cities in the region to loot them and to control them. Now, there wasn't much to do in this part of the world except either raise sheep or rob from each other. And so that's what this particular king or leader chose to do. And they attacked several cities in the region, including Sodom. Verse 12, they also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. We look there just to point out that of all places, Lot wound up living in Sodom, a place where we saw earlier there in chapter 13, verse 13, that the people there were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. Now, we don't know if Lot knew that before he moved into Sodom, but certainly he would have become aware of the kind of neighborhood he was in after he moved there. The rest of chapter 14 tells the story of Abram putting together his own army, just of those who had been born in his household. He had 318 grown men who were able to serve as kind of an army or group to go and to attack those who had captured Lot and had taken his goods and to win their release. So that's where the story kind of drops out for now in terms of Lot and his decisions. You can already see that what he had decided was really not that wise, and he'd gotten himself into a difficult situation. We don't know again exactly why, what the pressures might have been on him. What I think we can see as we continue that there certainly was some effect that his wife and his daughters had on the choices that he was making. Let's go over to chapter 19 as we continue. In the previous chapter, angels had visited Abram and had told him that they were going to destroy the city of Sodom. Knowing that his nephew lived there, Abram was very concerned and was asking how many righteous people would need to be there before God would spare the city. Obviously, his concern was for his family. In chapter 19, the angels arrive in Sodom. Now, it's kind of interesting, I think, that after all the difficulty they had had, after being attacked and robbed and looted, taken prisoner, and then finally released again, where did Lot go back to? He went back to Sodom again. He went back where he had had all the trouble in the first place. Interestingly, I guess you can say that Abram rescued Lot, and in effect, he rescued the city of Sodom. And that's where Lot had returned. Verse 1, it says that Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Now, that's a significant phrase, sitting in the gate. There are a number of reasons why Lot may have been there. Some commentators speculate that maybe it was his practice to sit at the gate and to look for innocent strangers who were coming into the city so that he could rescue them or offer them a place to stay at his home because of the dangers that they were inadvertently entering into. That's what he did when the angels came. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that Lot was a successful businessman, and business people, as custom, would sit at the gate and would do their business. There's a lot of commerce people coming and going, and it was maybe one of the busier places in the city. So perhaps that's why Lot was at the gate at the city of Sodom. Another possibility is that perhaps Lot was an official of the city. Because there are other examples in Scripture of the elders sitting at the gate. And they would be there in case there was any official business to conduct regarding the community and to help resolve disputes among the people. And it was a place where leaders would be found. Actually, as we continue, it may be that that's the best answer to why Lot was at the gate. In verses 2 through 5, again, I'm not going to read all of this. You can go back and read the story. Lot did not recognize the angels when they came as anything other than men. He didn't, as Abram had, Abram had recognized that they were representatives of Yahweh or of the Lord, but Lot didn't perceive that until later. He did, however, recognize something in them, and for whatever reason, he saw that they might be in danger unless he were to intervene and to offer them a place to spend the night. In these verses, we see that the wicked and perverted men of Sodom wanted to Lot to turn over his visitors to them for their purposes. But Lot refused to do so, and curiously, Lot offered his daughters instead. Now, I say curiously, it's kind of outrageously, really, that Lot would offer his daughters to these perverts and these wicked men in order to protect these strangers. Apparently, he felt it was his responsibility, since he had invited these people into his home, that he was responsible for their safety. And with that serious matter on his mind, he was willing to do whatever was necessary to be sure that they were safe. Drop down to verse 9. He just explained that he was wanting to protect those who were under his roof, those who had come to stay in his home. They answered him, verse 9, "Stand back." This is the crowd now dealing with Lot. "Stand back." And they said, "This one came in to stay here, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." So the mob turns pretty surly here. And they start making accusations about Lot. They said, "You're an outsider, but you came in here and you're acting like a judge. You're condemning us for what we're doing, for our practices, for who we are. Who are you to judge us?" is essentially what they're saying. "You came in to stay here." The margin in the New King James says that that phrase, "came in to stay," could be translated, "You are a resident alien." A resident alien. Keep that in mind. We're going to come back to that same definition a little bit later. He was apparently known within among the community or within the community for condemning their perversion and their evil. He was not caught up in it himself, but his family certainly was. We'll see that as we continue. Perhaps in his position as a community leader sitting at the gate, he would have opportunity to make judgments on the actions and the activities of those who lived in the city. But for whatever reason, in whatever capacity, he was well known to the people as being one who did not condone the lifestyles of those who lived in that city. So the angels struck the men blind, and that's when Lot seems to have caught on that these were people with supernatural powers. These were actually angels appearing as men who had come to him. Now, the lessons become clear and a little more clear in verses beginning here in verse 12 as we continue. Verse 12 says, "Then the men said to Lot," the angels said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here? Son-in-law, sons, daughters, whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Now, on a technical level here, there's a little bit of problem with the language. Apparently, although it says here that there speaks of the daughters being married, the Hebrew indicates that they were not married, they were betrothed. They were committed to marriage by betrothal to men who were of the local city, men who were citizens there, residents of Sodom. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters, in other words, again, to the men who were betrothed to his daughters, and he spoke to them urgently about the situation. He said, "Arise, take your wife." Oh, I'm sorry. Verse 15, the angels are speaking again. I skipped over the end of verse 14. To his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. So the family did not take him seriously. Good old dad. He's always ranting and raving about what's happening in our community. Always seems to be upset and angry. Never is able to calm down. He's just a buzzkill. He's always complaining and condemning others for what they're doing. So when he went to them to try to convince them that the city was about to be destroyed and they needed to escape, they thought he was just joking. They thought he was kidding. They thought he was, what he was saying was a joke. And so they dusted him off. Verse 15, when the morning came, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand and his wife's hand and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. So it came to pass, when they had brought them outside, he said, "Escape for your life. Run for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed." Notice that Lot lingered, even as this punishment was about to be unleashed. As we read through these passages, we see that Lot seems to have understood how evil and how perverted this place was. But his family was not convinced. They didn't believe his warning. Now, maybe his daughters were betrothed to pretty decent men who were part of that city. Maybe they weren't caught up in the perversion and the evil and the wickedness. As far as they were concerned, this is not such a bad place. They weren't part of what was of the worst of what was happening. And the daughters and even the wife, to that point, even the wife had their roots in that society. They had their plans for the future. They had their security there. They had their friends. They had their home. Everything that they lived for, everything that was normal to them, was part of that life in the city of Sodom. And here they were, Lot the crazy man, Lot the angry man, ranting again, telling them they had to leave everything behind and just walk away, just with the clothes on their back. So finally, the angels had to take him by the hand and drag him and his daughters and his wife out of the city. Drop down to verse 23. The sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. Even when they came out of Sodom, they were told to flee out into the mountains, and Lot begged again, "No, I want to go to a city. I want to go to a place." And so the angels shook their heads, most likely, and said, "All right, one more thing we'll give you here. We'll let you go to Zoar, but you have to get there before the city will be destroyed." The Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. He overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, sometimes you see these pictures that supposedly portray Lot and his family escaping. And they always show him and his wife kind of like they're moving quickly down a trail and out in the wilderness, and she's looking back over her shoulder toward the city. But that's not really what happened. Remember, in verse 23, it said that they had entered the city of Zoar. They were in a safe place. They weren't on the trail on the way. They were at the location that God was sending them to for their protection and safety. And so Mrs. Lott didn't just glance back over her shoulder when she heard the noise and the commotion. She was in her new city, and she was looking longingly across the plains to Sodom, the place that she loved, the place that was home to her, the place that was her normal. And so she was turned into a pillar of salt. If you want to have an interesting, humorous Bible study, go back and read some commentaries on what it means to be turned into a pillar of salt. A lot of different and sometimes strange ideas that are presented by the scholars. Doesn't really say exactly what that means, but the point is that because she longed for that strange and perverted society, God destroyed her and left her as an example to others who might also long for that kind of environment, for that kind of a place to live. You know, you probably could justify living in a place like that. Again, there were probably some good cultural opportunities, some good education opportunities, some commerce, some good jobs in a big, thriving city like that. And you didn't have to get all involved in the ugly side, the evil and wicked side. You could live there safely. And that's perhaps what his family wanted to do. God saw it very differently. He saw something there that was very dangerous, something that would harm others unless he stepped in and dealt with the city at that point. But everything was the way that they were used to. Everything was what they, speaking of his wife and daughters, it was what they found to be comforting. It was their normal, and they didn't want to leave. As I said, it was a disaster for the daughters and for his wife. It's not clear, really, from the scripture whether these two daughters who left with him or were dragged out at the same time he left, whether they were the same two that were already betrothed or whether he had two other daughters. It's not clear. But the family was broken and devastated and shattered. They had the opportunity to escape together, but his wife and his daughters were not willing. Now, God uses the sad story of Lot's family as an illustration of what will happen at the end of the age. Turn back to Luke 17. Luke, the 17th chapter. We begin in verse 26. Luke 17, 26. Jesus is speaking about conditions at the end of the age. We'll pick it up in the middle of this description. He says, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be again in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." In other words, life was perfectly normal up to the time when the flood started. They were going about their business as usual. Now, you can see that the kind of business that they were about was incredibly ugly. It says in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, that the Lord saw, and this is speaking of mankind before the flood, "The wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." This is what God saw when he looked at society prior to the flood. Every intent of the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually. But to them it was business as usual. It was normal. It was the way they lived. And we see here in Luke that right up to the moment the flood started, they were going about their normal lives, carrying on as they typically would. Likewise, verse 28, "as it was also in the days of Lot, They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. They lived their normal, everyday life. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Life continued in its normal pattern right up to the very end. Only Noah in his time, and only Lot in his time, understood and remained separate from the societies in which they were living. It says of Noah that he was found perfect in his generations. What that actually means is that he was separate from, and in his life he was not part of that evil, ugly society that he was living in. It wasn't normal to him. And so Noah recognized the times that he lived in, as did Lot, the people who lived there. Remember Genesis 19, verse 9, were uncomfortable with him, unhappy with him, because he judged them. They knew that he knew what they were doing was perverted and not acceptable in God's eyes. But you see, this was their world. This was their life. This was their normal. Verse 31 here in Luke 17 continues, In that day, he was on his housetop, and his goods are in his house. Let him not come down and take them away. And likewise, the one who is in his field, let him not turn back. Isn't that exactly what happened to Lot? The angels grabbed him by the arms or the hands and just drug him out of the city. He didn't have time to gather up all of his belongings and the things that were important to him, take them along with him. So Jesus is saying that it's going to be something like that at the end of the age. So what does that tell us about us at the end of the age? Well, let's read one other thought here. Verse 32. Remember Lot's wife. That statement in this context helps us to see the lesson of Lot's wife. That she did not want to leave all those good things behind. She longed to return to them. And probably felt more than a little bit angry that that city was being destroyed. To her, it was a terrible day, a tragic day. She didn't understand that God was using his scorched earth policy to cleanse that area of the evil that city represented. It goes on to say, whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. That's what Mrs. Lot did. She wanted her life back. She wanted what she had. She wanted that lifestyle. She wanted her normal. But whoever loses his life will preserve it. If we're willing to step aside from, give up what this world has to offer, then our lives will be preserved. So that's kind of a connection between what happened way back early in Genesis and what Christ says it's going to be like at the end of the age. And we see an important lesson. The end time lesson of Lot and his wife are a reminder to us, a reminder to God's people that someday, just as it was for Lot, people are going to have to be willing to walk away from it all. If a person's life is fully invested in this world, in this society, in this way, if that's what they want to preserve, then like Lot's wife, they will lose everything. The story of Lot really goes from one end of the Bible to the other. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 2. I'm going to begin reading in verse 4. This is a very long sentence. It begins at verse 4 and continues for several verses. So before we read it, let's kind of think ahead to what the conclusion is. The point that Peter is making in this lengthy sentence or in this passage is that God will protect and rescue those who do not get caught up in the evils of Satan's world. Again, living in Satan's world has a serious, there's a serious implication there, or a warning to us, that we not begin to accept that the way things are in this world are the way that they should be. It's what we're used to, it's what we've always known, it's what we're accustomed to. But the warning here is that that is not the way that life, that's not what we should connect our lives to. Now again, beginning of verse 4, it's a long sentence, and it has three examples in it. Three examples are given in this lengthy section. It says in verse 4, if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. So there's the first example. God punished the angels who rebelled. God is aware of the choices that we're making. When the angels rebelled, God stepped in and they were punished. They were held now, or they are held now, in chains. The word hell here is the Greek word tartaru, and it could be should be translated a place of restraint. So they're not down in the flames of hellfire, but they're simply in a place where God is restraining them in chains of darkness, held for judgment. The second example begins in verse 5. God did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. So the second example is of Noah. Remember we read, or I quoted to you Genesis 6 verse 5, that described the wickedness and the evil of mankind at the time of the flood. God saved Noah, but he destroyed the rest of the world for their evil. And the third example then begins, begins in verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes. Interesting, in Luke 17, also Matthew 24, and here in 2 Peter 2, two of the examples are the time of Noah and the time of Lot. Similar circumstances in some ways in terms of the destruction that came about and the reason for it. He turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. The time of the flood was an example or a warning of God's punishment on the world. He promised never to destroy the earth again by a flood, and yet it's a warning of God's anger and how he will deal with those who rebel against him. Same lesson from the life of Lot. Verse 7, and he delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. So there's, again, that third example. When you read just the story of Lot back in Genesis 19, you kind of wonder, how did Peter conclude that Lot was a righteous man? He did offer his daughters in place of his visitors, and he was slow, reluctant to leave the city of Sodom. But apparently Peter is picking up on that verse 9 where it says that in Genesis 19, where it says that Lot was known as one who was critical of and judged the people of Sodom for their perverseness and for their wickedness. So Peter gives him the benefit of the doubt, and so should we, that he was a righteous man. But notice some of the characteristics of his righteousness, how we know that he was, is that he lived among them, but he was tormented by their deeds. He was not part of what they were practicing. Lot lived among them, but he was not part of them. There's a lesson there for us. We're surrounded by the society that we live in. And frankly, it becomes fairly normal, doesn't it? Not always pleasant, not always easy, not generally good, but it's normal. It's the way that life is. Like Lot's family did, we make our plans in the world that we live in. We have our heart set on a future. We think about our plans, our hopes, our dreams, what we hope that our lives will offer as their lives continue. But if we put our hope, if we put our future, if we plan our lives as part of Satan's society, then we will have the same results that Lot and his family had. If we separate ourselves from the danger and from what others view as being normal in this world, then it says in verse 9 that God knows how to preserve those who separate themselves, as Lot did. Verse 9, then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. God knows the choices we're making. He knows the way that we're living. He knows where our heart is. And if our heart is in the world that we live in, if that is the way of life or the norm of life that we are connected to, then we're not in a very safe place. Lot was dwelling among them. I remember back in Genesis 19, it says that Lot came in to stay. He was a resident alien. He lived among the people, but he was not part of the way that they were living. Let's turn back a couple of pages to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter, the second chapter. Verse 11. Peter says, "Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." The word pilgrim in the Greek is the equivalent to the phrase that we saw in Genesis 19. The word pilgrim means a resident alien. It means a person who, for a period of time, lives in a place that is not his normal residence. Peter is exhorting Christians to recognize that this world is not the normal world. This world is not where we fit. This world is not our world. As Lot did, we live among them, but we are reminded not to be a part of them. Lot, as Peter is exhorting us to be, was a pilgrim. He was a resident alien. He was living in a place that was not his normal residence, not the place where he belonged. How do we separate ourselves? Peter continues the thought in verse 12, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, what did they speak? How do they speak of Lot? Well, they were very critical of him because he was judgmental of them. He didn't accept the way that they were. And if we choose to live differently, and if others take offense at that, they may speak evil of us also. But if they do, they may, at the end of verse 12, they may by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. The works that we produce are abnormal because they don't fit in with the trend. They don't fit in with the way that others perhaps are living their lives. It's a difference that we are willing to not only accept but to embrace, so that we recognize that we are temporarily living here. It's not where we belong. It's not our normal residence. Jesus spoke of it in much the same way in John 17. John 17 is a prayer. And in this prayer, Jesus Christ prays about us. He prays about the situation that we find ourselves in. John chapter 17, verse 15, as part of his prayer, Jesus said, "I do not pray that you would take them out of the world, but that you would keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world." Jesus is acknowledging that we have no place else to live. We have no place else to go. He's not going to take us out of the world itself, but he will provide us protection from the world, specifically from the master of this evil world. And as we think about it, he'll protect us from the life that people live in this world. And yet, as it says of Lot, we can be among, but not part of, the society. Not part of what the world is engaged in. But you see, what the world is engaged in, from their perspective, is entirely normal, because it is the way that everybody lives. It's the way that society is turned. But let's go back to the word normal and consider a different definition, or actually a proper definition of the word normal. I said at the beginning that normal is typically defined as being something that is expected or not out of the ordinary. It's just average. It's what would be anticipated or expected. The word normal, of course, is an adjective. Normal describes the way something is. It describes a noun. The noun form is the word norm. Not a man's first name, but the word is norm. It is something that is normal, is norm. Now, the word norm is derived, if you look at, you can see the derivation of the word in most dictionaries. It's in the square brackets that immediately follow the word. The word norm is derived from the Latin word norma, not a woman's name, which in turn is derived from a Greek word, nomon, G-N-O-M-O-N. But the word norm, or the word norma, literally means a carpenter's square. A carpenter's square. Now, you may not be familiar with what a carpenter's square is. There are various forms of it. Typically, a good quality one would be made out of metal. It's shaped like a big capital L. And it may be a couple of inches wide in its length, and then its height as well. And it forms a perfect right angle. It's often inscribed along the edges with inches or millimeters or distances that can be measured. But it's a big metal-shaped giant, or capital L, maybe 18 inches tall and 18 inches long. And it forms a perfect 90-degree angle. And it is essential in carpentry. It is the way that a building is squared, so that it will be straight and so that it will be stable. where the wall meets the floor is supposed to be exactly 90 degrees. And if a person is building a cabinet, again, the shape of it and the shelves inside are going to be useful, going to be fit, they're going to be functional when they are built properly and square. And that carpenter's square is the tool that can be used to assure that whatever it is you're building has that solid 90-degree angle. It is standard. It is constant. It is absolute. It is the norm. And what is built by using that carpenter's square is described as normal. There's no variation to it. A carpenter's square is not sometimes 82 degrees instead of 90. It's never any different shape. It is that exact and perfect 90-degree angle. Now, the word normal also has some very specific meanings in other disciplines, such as mathematics and chemistry. And we'll see, too, that normal has a very specific meaning in life. Here's an example. Here's the definition of normal in terms of mathematics. It means being at right angles as a line perpendicular. It also means pertaining to a mathematical normal. The normal of an orthogonal system of real functions is defined so that the integral of the square of the absolute value of any function is 1. Now you better stop laughing and start taking notes. There's going to be a test. That was the easy one. In chemistry, the normal of a solution is one containing one equivalent weight of the constituent in question in 1 liter of solution. Or, pertaining to an aliphatic hydrocarbon having a straight unbranched carbon chain, this is important, each carbon of which is joined to no more than 2 other carbon atoms. Got it? When we lived out in Oregon, there was a young man there who was a student at Oregon State University who was a chemistry major. He spoke kind of like this. We would have conversations, sometimes lengthy ones, and I had absolutely no idea what we were talking about. These definitions, the mathematical and chemistry definitions, mean nothing to me either, but here's my point. In common usage regarding our society, normal is a moving target. What's normal today might be different tomorrow, or something else might be normal tomorrow that wasn't today. It changes to reflect what is common, what is typical, what is accepted. What society does is considered to be normal. Now, today, it's normal to have a daycare center in a high school. Doesn't that strike you as odd? But it's normal. It's typical to have a daycare center inside the building of a high school. It's normal for a state to legalize same-sex marriage. Why is it normal? Because that's what people do. That's what the trend is. That's the way things are going. And so it's not unusual. Is it right? Is it true? Is it the way that normal actually is? It's normal for nations to go to war. It's normal for politicians to lie and make empty promises. All that is normal in society because normal is the accepted trend. But the real meaning of norm or of normal is an unchanging and specific standard. That's what normal means. It is the standard that governs Sometimes it may govern the way a building is constructed, may govern the way a mathematical equation is resolved. Normal governs life. God's law is normal. God's law is the standard. Anything outside that law is wrong. No matter how common it is, no matter how many people do it, it's wrong. It's like a carpenter holding a carpenter's square against a crooked wall. You know, if all the walls in the room are at an odd angle, it doesn't make the building straight. It doesn't make the walls normal. The carpenter's square is the standard, and it defines the way things ought to be. There's a place in Santa Cruz, California. It's called the Mystery Spot. You may have heard of it, or something else like it. It's a little tourist trap. My wife and I were there a few years ago. It was on our honeymoon, actually, so quite a few years ago. That's not funny. But we stopped at this little tourist trap, and there are others like it. There's a similar one to it in Southern Oregon. We took our family there several years later. You may have seen one yourself at other locations. For a few dollars, you can walk through this little shack they build into the side of a hill, and they will demonstrate to you that the laws of gravity do not apply in that particular spot, in that mystery spot. And they'll demonstrate it for you. They can put a ball on the end of a board that looks like this, and it rolls that way, rolls up. You start on one end of a room and walk across, and you get shorter as you go across. The wall, you can stand on the wall. In fact, if you stand straight in the room, you look like this, and you're standing, as far as you can tell, you're standing straight, but the room around you would say that you are standing at an angle. The most common explanation they'll give to you is that extraterrestrials have buried some anti-gravity material underneath that mystery spot as part of a guidance system that interferes with our system of gravity. The Santa Cruz mystery spot was first opened in 1939. And they claim that in all those years since then, that scientists have supposedly never been able to explain this phenomenon of this mystery spot. Well, obviously they build their little shed into the side of a hill, and they construct it at odd angles to create the illusion. But when you step inside that building, you become disoriented. And what you thought was up really is either level or down, and you can't explain why you feel disoriented, but it's because all the angles are just wrong. And it's built into the side of this hill to skew everything just enough that it creates this appearance of gravity not working the way that it's supposed to. You know, if we become disoriented in life, then everything looks skewed. And things don't work the way they're supposed to. They don't look the way they're supposed to. The laws are still there. The normal is still normal. But our perception is skewed. And that's how Satan has built his society. His world is built with skewed angles that create an illusion of legitimacy and make things that are odd appear to be normal, when in fact it's all a trick. The world we live in is one giant tourist trap. False explanations can be given that sound good, but they mean nothing. Satan's world is not normal. And it's essential that we recognize that he is simply, as the great deceiver, fooling the world with this elaborate illusion. Let's conclude in Romans chapter 12. It's a very convincing illusion. It's a very appealing illusion. There's a lot in it that seems to be attractive. There's a lot in it that could be easy to catch ourselves up in. But it's not a normal world. And in some cases, in some ways, it's not even a real world. Romans chapter 12, verse 2, says, "Do not be conformed to this world." Don't get caught up in being like or being part of or being attached or connected to the world that we live in, because it is an illusion. It is abnormal. It is unreal. Don't be conformed to this world that we see all around us, but be transformed. Be changed. Become something else than what the world has to offer. There's a lot we can learn from Lot's family. The tragedy of getting caught up in and becoming part of the twisted and perverted society they lived in. It led to the destruction of their family. As Paul says here, rather than being caught up in that way, we should transform, we should change the way that we think and be sure that it is based on the constant, unchanging norm of God's law, which is a standard, it is a constant, it is permanent. And regardless of what Satan does to manipulate and to change and to create this illusion in his world, regardless of what he is doing, God's law remains that standard that never changes and always defines what is right. And then we can live normally in an abnormal world.